You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
According to a recent study by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the number of heroin-related deaths in the United States tripled from 3,086 in 2010 to over 8,200 in 2013, an average of 23 people each day. Addicts increasingly tend to be young and white from rural and suburban areas. In Dreamland, The True Tales of America's Opiate Epidemic, journalist Sam Kanonis looks at how those heroin deaths are directly related to the overmarketing of pain medications in pill mills across the country and how the unfettered growth of highly addictive OxyContin during the 1990s created an ever-growing base of addicts who were lured to cheaper black tar heroin. It's published by Bloomsbury, and I'm very pleased it has brought Sam Kanonis to our show today. Hello.
Very nice to be here. Thanks very much for having me.
What is black tar heroin? Isn't that the kind of the crudest form?
It is. It's a semi-processed form of heroin. I grew up in the 70s watching the great New York movies about heroin, The French Connection, Serpico, and these kinds of things. And for the longest time, I thought heroin only came in white powder form. When I was a crime reporter in Stockton, California, many years ago, I learned that actually that's the most processed, the white powder is the most processed form of heroin. Black tar is the semi-processed, and it's just as addictive, creates just the same kind of withdrawals, the same kind of euphoria. It's just got a lot more impurities in it.
And does that mean that it's less predictable?
No, it's just cheaper.
Now, when did you first learn about Jalisco and the young men who traffic black tar heroin? There are two Jaliscos, aren't there? There's one that starts with the letter J, and there's right. one that starts with the letter X.
And that threw me for a bit, I have to say. Jalisco with a J is an enormous state, the center of which is Guadalajara, very well known. This was a town, I lived in Mexico for 10 years, I'd never heard of Jalisco with an X, Jalisco Nayarit. Nayarit is a small state in Mexico along the coast, Pacific coast. I'd never heard of that town. I heard of it for the first time when I was investigating, as part of a series of stories for the LA Times, how a lot of people were dying of black tar heroin in West Virginia. And it turns out the police in West Virginia were telling me, well, we've got all of a sudden this big surge of black tar heroin from Mexico. There's no Mexicans in West Virginia. I called Columbus, Ohio, which is where a lot of the drugs were coming from, and it was there that a DEA agent told me the story, this strange story of how Columbus had had no heroin until about 10 years before, and all of a sudden these Mexican guys began to come to town, driving around heroin, delivering heroin as if it were pizza, and they were the ones who were selling black tar heroin, and they were all from one town, and that town turns out to be one of the most prolific suppliers of heroin to the United States.
They're functioning like fast food franchises?
Correct.
Are they in competition with each other?
They are. They're in competition with each other and almost nobody else. They go to towns where there's no competition. They don't come to New York City, for example. There's entrenched gangs with guns. Baltimore, they avoid that place, too. They're looking
for
towns.
And you say that they don't want to sell to African-Americans.
Right. They're afraid of being robbed. There's a rule almost among these guys from this one town of Jalisco and Nayarit that you don't sell to blacks. They're afraid of getting robbed. So they don't sell to blacks. They also found the white market to be the market, the most affluent market, and that's where they sell.
You write that Christmas Day was big for dealers who opened for business awaiting junkies wanting to exchange for the gifts they or their children had received. So they do barter as well?
What I learned about the Jalisco boys was that they were particularly attuned to customer service. This is kind of where they really made their money. They were not about shooting it out for territory. They were about appealing to the convenience that an addict needed. And so if an addict needed was interested in bartering things, they were open to that idea. They were particularly interested, by the way, especially early on, in bartering heroin for Levi's 501 jeans. This was a startling thing that I realized that in the 90s, when this system, this pizza delivery system for heroin was expanding and they were taking it really nationwide, they began to realize that they could trade black tar heroin for Levi's 501s, that addicts would were terrific shoplifters would go in and clean out a JCPenney's or a Mervyn's or whatever it happened to be, and they would trade those straight across for a hit of heroin.
And then they could take the jeans back to Mexico.
And then they become like Santa Claus. Exactly right. They go home with a big stack of Levi's 501s and give it out to their nephews and their uncles. And it also was important in the spread of this system because as kids back home saw that you could come back home with a ton of Levi's 501s, everybody began raising their hands and saying, hey, I'll do that too. I'll drive heroin around Nashville or Salt Lake City or wherever.
Do the Jalisco boys ever use their heroin?
Never. I've never heard of it happening. They drink a lot. In the United States, I should say, they don't do anything. They don't drink. They don't use drugs. They don't party. They have designed a system that is they have innovated a system that is designed to make them look as if they are the smallest time hustlers on the street.
You tell the story of a young man named Enrique throughout the book. Is he typical of these heroin traffickers?
I think he is in the following regard. He was a poor kid, kind of relegated, humiliated by his poverty and his parents' poverty for many years. And he found in heroin and in this system a way of elevating himself, not only economically, but also socially. So he was viewed with a kind of enhanced reputation back home because he was giving jobs to people. He had money for his family. He built a house. All this kind of, he had a new truck. All these kinds of things come along with heroin. And that's what I found in this town, that heroin kind of levels the social playing field in a sense where people are able to be more equal.
Is it his goal to stay here or to become rich and eventually move back to Mexico?
No, his goal was always to go back to Mexico. In fact, that's what he did repeatedly. He would run the system. He mainly had a system going in a store, they call them stores, a store going in Santa Fe, New Mexico. And he would really go back to Mexico a lot because that's where he ran less risk.
My guest is Sam Quiñones. His book, Dreamland, The True Tale of America's Opiate Epidemic. You're calling this an epidemic. What drugs are classified as opiates other than heroin?
You have a number of synthetic. Obviously, there's morphine, of course, and other drugs that are made from that. Codeine is an opiate as well. There's also synthetic opiates that are derived from drugs that are made from opiates, and one of those is oxycodone. Oxycodone is the drug in OxyContin. OxyContin actually stands for oxycodone continuous, and it's a time release formula that really is the basis of that drug.
But that has to be made by a pharmaceutical, doesn't it?
Right, exactly. That's a legitimate drug, and it has a legitimate medical use.
I would assume that the pharmaceutical company knows that a fair amount of what it's making is being sold illegally.
Correct. I think it's always,
and they probably even rely on the money that comes in from that.
I think you'd have to ask them that, but I would bet that's a good. I would say that's probably a good bet.
Is heroin easier to make than morphine?
I think they're both not so difficult to make anymore. Everybody knows how to make it. They're made in very different ways. Heroin is a folk craft kind of drug, and in for example, in Mexico, Chinese immigrants brought the poppy over in the early part of the 1900s. It grows very nicely in certain parts of northwest Mexico. There now is a very deep folk craft in harvesting not first the goo, the opium goo from the poppy, but then, of course, cooking it, in a process that kind of resembles a backyard barbecue, into black tar heroin.
Now, I have poppies in my backyard,
right,
but I couldn't extract heroin.
No, probably because the elevation is not where. I mean, I think this drug, this flower needs a certain elevation to grow and to be industrially, let's say, manufactured.
So I guess I'm not going to augment my salary here.
Probably a good idea.
Have studies been done as to how many times people must take an opiate before they become addicted?
No, I think generally the feeling is that it's different for every person. However, I was overcome by a distinct feeling as I did this book that these are not drugs that can be at all used recreationally. I grew up in the 70s. You could recreationally smoke pot, and it would really not be a problem back then. I think that's changed too. But heroin and these opiates are very, very quickly addict people, and it's a little bit, in my view, I came to view it as kind of playing with a loaded gun, honestly.
But when it was created, wasn't it first believed that it was not addictive in
Correct.
The late 1800s?
Yes, in fact,
and,
we're seeing...
And cocaine was also seen as an
Exactly. They were looking for... they found this drug to be a perfect for, say, tuberculosis. The way you die of a heroin overdose is that the drug convinces your brain to stop telling your lungs to breathe. So it's a terrific respiratory drug, and it became a drug that people used to suppress tuberculosis cough and so on.
Well, the body is actually built to receive it. Because endorphins are a form of opiate,
right.
and we create them naturally.
Exactly.
So when you take heroin, you're just sending it to the same place.
Except for this is kind of a nuclear blast of endorphins, whereas say cuddling a baby, which also provide you with a certain shot of endorphins is a milder. This is just an overloading of the reward system.
In what ways does heroin, as you write, lend itself to the structured underworld business?
Yeah, it's a good question. What I came to realize was that this, first of all, this is a drug that a consumer, once he is addicted, cannot not buy. So you have a consumer who must buy your product. And not only once a day, but usually five times a day. Heroin turns people into hyper consumers. They start thinking about buying, they buy, and then they start thinking about buying again. And it's the same product over and over again. So you can structure a business pretty much along business school principles.
But wouldn't the opening of methadone clinics have cut into the business of the Jalisco Boys?
In their case... it's in their case, it actually helped because they were the ones who figured out or they were the ones who systematically, let's put it that way, systematically figured out that if they hang out in front of methadone clinics, passing out free samples and the telephone number that you call to get your dope delivered as if it were pizza, that's for many years, the methadone clinics was the only place you could really reliably find opiate addicts. This was before the pills. In places like in the Western United States, that's where you went. That's where you really would find these folks. Later, of course, as pills, as the heavy prescribing of opiate painkillers took place, obviously the numbers of addicts proliferated geometrically. But for the first 15, 20 years of this system's life, these guys realized hanging out in a methadone clinic was the place to be.
But before the methadone clinics, there were things like the U.S. Narcotics Farm, where some pretty famous people went to detox. They did studies there. And was that linked to Lexington, where people who were arrested on drug charges were often sent?
Yes, that's the same thing. In the 1930s, the prison system was being overwhelmed by all the drug addicts. They'd had 20 years before the Harrison Act had made cocaine and heroin illegal. A lot of those addicts who once had not been incarcerated were now being incarcerated. They were undermining kind of the stability of the prisons. And so during the Depression, they built FDR built the narcotics farm, calling it a New Deal for the addict, and in time it became an amazing place, really. It was a remarkable experiment. I mean, you had, first of all, it's probably the most integrated, 100 acres of America, because it brought addicts from all over, and it was Latinos and gay people and blacks and whites and everybody, men and women. It also brought, after Charlie Parker revolutionized jazz with his bebop style of play. He was also a heroin addict, and he created not just a whole legion of terrific players, but players who got addicted to heroin, and huge numbers of them, Sonny Rollins, Elvin Jones.
Rodney, who played with Charlie Parker.
All these guys went to the farm, and they formed, through the years, they formed one of the greatest jazz bands. It was never recorded, but it was a remarkable.
So why was it shut down in the 70s?
I think because it had always been a place where they had done experiments on people, on addicts, and addicts signed up willingly, voluntarily. Hey, I'll be a part of that. You're going to give me free dope. I'll be a part of that. But they became linked to certain experiments run by the CIA on people, and with the Church Commission in the 1970s, they basically shut it down. And it's now, it still exists. It's just a medical prison, a federal medical prison now.
Interestingly, in Great Britain, you could be arrested for marijuana, but if you were a heroin addict, you went to a doctor who prescribed the heroin for you, and they felt that that was a more effective approach.
Right, and I think that that idea kind of also started, what I believe to be the beginnings of the hospice movement that brought that, and that came here. It started, I think, first in the UK.
Sam Quinones' latest book is Dreamland, The True Tale of America's Opiate Epidemic. It is published by Bloomsbury Press. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Sam Quinones, Quinones. His latest book, Dreamland, The True Tale of America's Opiate Epidemic, published by Bloomsbury. In 1980, the World Health Organization Cancer Chief established norms for treating dying cancer patients with opiates, primarily morphine. What effect did labeling morphine as an essential drug in cancer pain relief have on public and medical opinion?
I think primarily on medical opinion, it allowed for the use now of this drug in particularly in for terminal patients that for a long time, particularly in the U.S., there had been this real phobia about these drugs, using them at all for any reason whatsoever.
So people who were suffering terrible pain were still denied any painkillers because they were afraid they were going to make them into junkies?
Precisely. Even though they might have only, 3 to 6 months to live, the fear was more that they would be addicted at death rather than they would live a life of decency free of pain in the last days.
Who was Dr. Russell Portnoy? What role did he play in the promotion of and marketing of opiates to patients?
Right. Dr. Portnoy is a doctor here in New York City. He declined to talk to me for the book, but he is one of the doctors who grew up in this period when opiates were really denied most people. And it was a searing experience that if you're a doctor into medicine to help people and all around you are people who are in excruciating pain and you're not allowed to give them these very humane drugs to relieve that pain, that it can change your life. And he then essentially went on a crusade, I think it's a fair term to use, to liberalize the use of these drugs.
Another influential doctor, Dr. Herschel Jick, and his colleagues submitted a one-paragraph letter to the New England Journal of Medicine that had a major impact.
Yes. Dr. Jick really was tangential to this story, and he didn't expect to be part of this story. But he wrote a letter to the New England Journal of Medicine in 1980 saying that he had a database and his data of hospital records, and the hospital records showed that only a very, very less than 1% of all people who were given opiate, narcotic painkillers in hospital ever grew addicted to them. He writes this out in a 101-word letter, sends it in, the New England Journal of Medicine publishes it, and he forgets about it because it's not really much of a letter. He himself recognized, I interviewed him, he says, this was not a letter that I thought was much of anything, I just thought I'd point this out.
But it's not true.
In his case, it is true. When you use painkillers in hospital when they remember this was from a time when the painkillers were extremely well controlled in hospital, you're only getting small amounts of painkillers to small numbers of people, then yes, the addiction rate is small. When, however, what happened was the pain crusaders that grew up in 1980s and into the 1990s used this letter to say, see, these pills, these opiate painkillers are non-addictive, virtually non-addictive when used for pain. But Herschel Jick never meant it that way. He said when used in hospital, when rigidly controlled, they're non-addictive. When you send them home in bottles of 60 or 90 pills to people you haven't tested or you don't know anything about, then there's going to probably be a problem. And that's what happened.
What were the press Gainey surveys?
They were probably a very good idea that has an unintended consequence. Their survey
is... talking about a lot of unintended consequences.
Oh, this is an entire story about that, of those. The Press-Ganey surveys are surveys that patients can fill out to say how to let people know how they thought their doctor treated them, whether their doctor was receptive and responsive, and et cetera. And that's a very good idea, of course. It's not a bad idea to have some kind of feedback for a doctor. The problem is people began to feel more entitled to be free of pain. That eventually, what they began judging doctors based on how well they gave, how many pills they gave them or didn't give them. And bad Press-Ganey scores meant that you as a doctor could sometimes be fired or reassigned, or you'd have problems from that.
If I were a heroin addict and I was unable to get my heroin, could I take opium or morphine and get past the problem?
Sure.
Are they interchangeable?
They are.
The reason I ask is now we come to OxyContin.
Right.
Now, OxyContin is not a real opiate because it doesn't come from poppies.
No, but it's synthesized from pills that do come from.
Why was it even developed if you already have an awful lot of opium out there on the market? Afghanistan alone probably could supply every person in pain in the world 100 times.
It really was designed not to be an opiate. It was designed to deliver opiates in an opiate painkiller over a period of 12 hours. Before OxyContin, it was a game changer in a few ways. Number one, it allowed a pain patient to only take two pills a day. That's a huge change. That's a life-changing event. If you only have to take two pills a day and it kind of leaks the drug into your system. The drug it does this with is oxycodone, which was developed in the early part of the 1900s. But because it contains no other abuse deterrents, like Vicodin contains Tylenol and acetaminophen to limit the abuse of it. It's just straight dope. So once you, as a street user, can suck off the time-release coating around the pill, then you have a full whack of dope.
And you crush it and...
I'm sorry?
Do you crush it into a powder?
Yeah, if you can do that, you could just take it. You could just take it orally. You could crush it into a powder. You can smoke it, or eventually what people, as their tolerance grew, people began shooting it up. And this provided the bridge between the earlier painkillers like Vicodin and Percocet and Lortab and heroin, because you had this bridge that would take you... Most people who would abuse Vicodin or Lorset or Percocet wouldn't really transition to heroin, but now you had a bridge that would take you there.
Was the pharmaceutical company that developed it, Purdue Frederick, aware that it was being abused?
Wow, that's a good question. I mean, I think you'd have to ask them that, but I think that there was eventually a realization, yes, that this was not a drug that was virtually non-addictive.
And then we had things like Rush Limbaugh being arrested for buying it illegally.
What ended up happening was doctors bought into the idea, promoted by pain specialists, that there was a very, very minimal risk of addiction when you use these pills. And there was this rising sea level nationwide of pills all across the country. People then became addicted to them, a lot more people than they ever expected. And the result is what we have today.
And you found that Oxy prescriptions for pain rose from 670,000 in 1997 to 6.2 million
right.
in 2002. I imagine it's even higher today.
Right. They're selling, according to a Fortune magazine article, they're selling $1 billion worth of that drug every year.
So. Are some doctors now reluctant to
prescribe it? I think that's
it?
Growing, yes. I think people across the country are saying, gee, maybe we ought to check this. The problem is that you get into the kind of the pendulum swinging too far the other way, where you do have people who have legitimate chronic pain who do need these pills. These do have a medical use, and they're now having a more difficult time getting them prescribed.
My guest is Sam Quinones. His book, Dreamland, The True Tale of America's Opiate Epidemic, published by Bloomsbury. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. What kinds of pains are we talking about Oxy being prescribed for?
Well,
sore knees,
yes.
Fibromyalgia, things
all
like that?
All that kind of stuff. one of the most startling I learned was that when you get your wisdom teeth out, you're now given these pills. And it depends on the dentist which one he gives you, I think. But I would say also one new very sadly fertile terrain for addiction is athletics, high school and college athletics. Football is now almost a gateway to heroin addiction because football and lacrosse and other sports of that kind are accompanied by lots of pain, lots of chronic pain throughout a season. You're hurt and it doesn't heal. And so what you're finding now is a lot of athletes have become addicted to this stuff. And a lot of it, I think, also is due to the fact that there's a great pressure to get them to play again, get them back on the field. They want to get back on the field. They're demanding it. There's not a lot of education about how dangerous these drugs are and that maybe really the solution, sadly for you, quarterback, is to just stay off the field for a while.
And are the Jalisco boys aware of that? Are they selling it to athletes?
Yeah, it's always a good question how much these guys know about why they have such a great market.
Because they seem to have scouts who bring them into areas where there's a potential market.
Everywhere they've gone, they've been led there by addicts who have been paid in heroin. Some of these guys certainly have understood the pill market. In fact, the Jalisco boys were the first ones to exploit the emerging pill market, primarily in the Columbus, Ohio, West Virginia, Eastern Kentucky region.
You write about the town of Chillicothe, Ohio.
Right. In late 1998, a guy arrives there with a system in Columbus, and he begins to understand that the pill market will create a much, much larger market of addicts than they've ever had the access to back in the West Coast. And he expands there. Now, how many of the drivers who speak no English, who are there for 9 months and just really want to go back with some money, how much of the pill market they fully understand, I'm not quite sure.
But it sounds to me like the Jalisco boys understood that if you take these pill addicts and you help them, they will transition to the black tar heroin that they specialize in.
Exactly. And they also specialize in keeping an addict going, in a sense. They have a whole bunch of come-ons, discounts, free giveaways that as soon as an addict looked as if he's about to quit, boom, they're right there with free dope. Or as soon as the addict gets out of jail after being clean for a while, boom, they're right there getting using again.
What did the local police in the towns that you visited tell you about opiate abuse? How did they deal with addicts and drug dealers?
You know, it's all over the map. I mean, obviously, every place you go, I found it to be a nationwide story.
I think a cop is calling you right now. Your phone just went off.
There we go. The story is the same. Every place you go, all our addicts are young or getting younger. They're all white. And by the way, they all start with pills, and eventually they have to transition. If they don't get treatment, they transition to heroin.
But the first pushers, in a way, are the pill mills, aren't they?
Let me put it this way. This is the first drug scourge we've had since World War II, the post-World War II era, that has not come from the mafia or the underworld or street drug traffickers. If you think about cocaine and crack, that came from Colombians, and then the Bloods and the Crips very famously shot it out for territory all across America. This is the first drug scourge that comes really instead from over-prescribing of legitimate medication.
And doctors doing it knowing that they're doing something wrong?
No, I don't believe so.
Well, let's say Dr. David Proctor.
There are some who are scandalous, like Dr. Proctor, who then did 12 years in prison and just recently was released. Sure, there's a pill mills across the country. I believe most doctors, 99%, I dare say, across the country, want to help their patients, and they do that. They prescribe these painkillers for that reason, because their patients are demanding a resolution to their pain problems.
Many of the people who you're talking about who become addicted are in red states. And how are local politicians dealing with it? Republicans have traditionally taken a hard-line attitude toward drug addiction.
Yes, I'm about to embark on a story that gets into more detail about that for a magazine. But the idea is certainly true, that the more addicts you see around you that you know, that you went to church with, maybe it's your son or a nephew or a business partner's son or daughter or what have you, it sensitizes people. And so what I think has happened in a lot of areas that were where they thought the issue of crime and punishment and prison and rehab was settled, and the kind of the throw away the key attitude was really the one that predominated, those attitudes are now getting really reassessed in very deep ways. You see, the state of Kentucky has just passed a heroin law that allows for needle exchange. You see these kinds of movements, all related to the fact that we have now a widespread addiction, largely of young white kids.
So they're seeing their own kids and neighbors
precisely
become addicted.
Yeah.
And then in Washington state, the state's attorney general took Purdue to court in 2007. What was he?
No, it was in Virginia. In Virginia, they took the federal attorney, the U.S. attorney in Virginia, took Purdue to court filed a criminal charges against them for misbranding. Eventually, the company pled guilty to one misdemeanor charge of misbranding, paid a $634 million fine. That's the only time it's been so charged.
So do the Jalisco Boys continue to operate their cells throughout the United States?
They do. They're I think, doing gangbusters. I would say that the big difference now is, however, that the entire underworld is aware of this pill to heroin phenomenon. I think this is all over the place. The big cartels in Mexico have definitely figured it out. I think a lot of other minor dealers around this country. And so
the old drug dealers, the mob.
And also every addict that you create is a potential dealer, because eventually you can't work to support your habit. You're going to have to sell. And so what's happened now is they are sharing those markets that they once had, I would say, you know, pretty much dominance over. They're having to share those markets now with a whole bunch of other folks.
Mm-hmm. And some people go to jail for abuse. Others wind up with nationally broadcast radio shows. But
the great irony of American life. Do we see
have judges been adjusting to the situation?
I think the increasing use of drug courts is happening across the country, where instead of slapping a felony on somebody, you go through drug court, you go through NA, you do a lot of things, jump through a lot of hoops over a period of a year or two, and you get that felony expunged. People are understanding now, particularly in communities, rural and suburban communities, that you have you have a felony on your record. It's about as life mangling as a heroin addiction.
The reason I ask is because whenever you look at prison populations, so many of the people there are African Americans or Latinos who have been sentenced, given long sentences for drug abuse of one sort or another. But I'm getting a feeling that there's a kind of a double standard here.
It's possible. I think what's happened is, you know, I think it's very similar to what's happened with gay marriage. You know, that people begin to know the realities, you know, that they had the luxury of never knowing before. And now they see it up front and up close and personal. And it's changing a lot of hearts and minds. And I'm in my charitable moments, I call it a kind of a Christian opening, let's call it that.
Okay, let's end on that positive note.
There you go.
Sam Quinones, his latest book, Dreamland, The True Tale of America's Opiate Epidemic, published by Bloomsbury. Thank you so much for being on our show.
It's been great to be here. Thanks so much.